welcome. This is Saturday night, October 15th, 2005, time for the Saturday Evening Libertarian Conversation. And I will be your host for the next 2 hours on the Genesis Network. I am Harry Brown, and I'm so pleased to be with you. We will talk about various matters, political and social, and you're invited to join the show by calling 1-800-259-9231. 1-800-259-9231. And I can't take your emails tonight because I'm in a hotel room in Atlanta. But I certainly can take your phone call with comments, questions, criticisms, anything you have in mind. 1-800-259-9231. A number of questions have come in during the week or over the last couple of weeks that we haven't gotten to on the show. And I thought I'd start out with those. And the first question especially, I think, is a very, very valuable question to pinpoint some important points. And that is a question that I got out in cyberspace, and I have to admit that somehow or other, with all the questions I brought with me to Atlanta, this one particular one got lost, but I remember the question quite well, but I can't tell you who sent it in. The question was, there is a site that points out all the weaknesses in libertarianism, all the problems with libertarianism, and one of the things that they show on that site is various, what I would call, lifeboat situations. In other words, situations that seem to have no possible remedy to them whatsoever, no possible good answer. And the expression lifeboat situation comes from the idea that if you and I are in a lifeboat someplace and you decide to drill a hole in your end of the lifeboat, do I have the right to try to stop you? Do I have the right to use force, aggression, to try to stop you from drilling a hole in your end? That's the lifeboat situation. And the particular example that is given is plane crashes, and it's out in the desert, and there are five people who survive the plane crash, but they are having trouble surviving in the desert, and they keep walking and walking, and they are just about out of nutrients. They're about to die if they don't get water, and they arrive at a house. And there's a man there, and he refuses to give them water or food or anything else. And these five people are going to die if they don't get water and food. Do they have the right, in a libertarian world, to take the water and food from the man? Is he guilty of murder if he doesn't give it to them? Are they guilty of aggression if they take it from him? And what would happen in a libertarian world? Well, what would happen in any world? In any world, it would be a difficult situation and a difficult choice for the people to make. What we have here is not a question of political organization of society, of having a libertarian world in which libertarian rules of interaction among individuals are enforced in some way, somehow. But rather, what we have is a case of individual libertarianism, of what an individual will do to live his life. And that's a different story altogether. And as far as I'm concerned, I know that if I steal something from someone, there are going to be consequences to me. And I have to recognize that if I'm one of those five people and I decide to wrench the food and water from the man who refuses to give it to me. Now, I can say afterward, I had to do that or I would have died. But anybody who knows me then would have to wonder whether in the future I was in a situation of really life and death and might take something from that person. That's an individual decision that I have to make as part of my moral code of conduct, my way of living. It has nothing to do with how to organize society. Now, there are various answers to the question, as there are various answers to many moral questions, but they all involve individual conduct, individual codes of conduct, rather than interaction among individuals and how they are expected to act among each other in a libertarian society, how they're supposed to act towards each other. And we need to understand that. We need to understand that there are two entirely separate things. I wrote a book called How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World way back. It came out in 1973, 32 years ago. And I hope that it will come out again. It was republished in 97 after going out of print, and then it fell out of print again, and it will, I hope, be published again sometime in the next year. And the whole point of the book was to lay out an individual libertarian code of conduct. Not the code of conduct, but a code of conduct that could inspire individuals to develop a code of conduct of their own. And that was an individual libertarian approach to the matter. There was very, very little in there about societal approach to libertarianism, although the principles were the same, and you would be bound to notice the similarity if you read the book. But my point is this, that we can confuse things in this way, and we shouldn't confuse things in this way. We shouldn't take lifeboat situations and try to apply them to society and say that here's an ironfast rule and so forth, when what we're really talking about is individual decisions and how an individual would react. Well, I also got a question from Eric. Incidentally, if you have any comments about that and anything that you think would cast some light on that, I hope you'll call in and let me know, because it is an important and an interesting aspect of the libertarian world and the libertarian thinking. Eric, in Southern California, I'm sure, wrote to say, in Los Angeles this past week, we had many wildfires. The government is patting itself on the back for all the brush clearance laws that were obeyed this time around, which resulted in only a few houses burning down. How would a libertarian world handle brush clearance laws like those that we have now? If my neighbor does not clear his brush and it catches fire and the embers fly into my barn and cause a fire, would I be able to sue for damages? What if my neighbor's home is also destroyed and he has no resources left to pay me for the damage? Would a libertarian world use insurance companies to require fireproofing? Would there be CCs and Rs, builder contracts, with buyers? Or what would you see as the solution here? Well, that's a good question, and I think we should defer it now until we come back from our first break. We have some important words from sponsors. So let's take those words first so that we can examine this in detail. And if you have any ideas on the subject, give me a call at 1-800-259-9231. This is Harry Brown. We'll be right back.
You're an adult, right? You're old enough to vote.
You've got a job and a car. Maybe you have a family and own a home. So why do the politicians treat you like a child?
At DownsizedDC.com, we believe you should be free to make your own decisions.
About your health care, your retirement, your children's education. At DownsizedDC.com, we don't trust the politicians. We believe in you.
We believe if you had the chance, you'd slash federal spending, put an end to government waste and corruption, and dramatically reduce your taxes today.
In short, we believe you'd downsize D.C.
Year after year, the federal government expands, meddling in every area of your life.
Make your own decisions. Visit DownsizeDC.com. That's DownsizeDC.com.
Back. This is Harry Brown, and the phone number is 1-800-259-9231. I welcome your call, your comments. And before we went to the break, I took the question from Eric in which he said that the government had passed brush clearance laws that forced homeowners to make sure that all the dead foliage, I guess it is, around their houses were all cleared away so that they couldn't catch fire and burn down their neighbors' homes and so on and so forth. And so only a few houses burned down. And how would a libertarian world handle brush clearance laws that we have now? First of all, the fire season isn't over yet, and we'll just have to see what happens. But secondly, the question of how would a libertarian world handle brush clearance laws? Let's suppose that there were no brush clearance laws whatsoever. Well, what would happen is a few houses would burn down as a result of that, and people would stop buying houses in the fire areas. And people who wanted to sell property in the fire areas would have a hard time selling those homes. So they would have to hire somebody who's got the brains to figure out a way to make absolutely sure that nobody is vulnerable to his neighbor's foliage. And the nice thing about the free market is you don't have to know the answer to everything. When Y2K came back in 2000, I didn't know how it was going to be solved. I could think of a few ways that it might be solved, and I saw a few ways by which it was already being solved. But there were other ways being developed all the time. And I didn't know what those ways were. I didn't know how they worked. I didn't know how to program the computer to make sure that everything was taken care of in time and so forth. I could imagine some ways from the little programming I've had in the past, but that just was because I happened to have had some programming experience. But the point is that we don't have to know all these things because there are other people who want to make money and who do know how to do these things. Somebody's going to figure out how we're going to make sure that I can buy a house and not be vulnerable to my neighbor's brush, that my neighbor can't, by his, laxity, cause my house to burn down. And there may be some kind of restrictive covenant laws. As you say, it may be the insurance companies will make absolutely sure that nobody has that kind of situation. They might come and inspect before they would even issue any fire insurance. And as Eric says, would they regulate fireproofing? Yes, probably in some way. As it is, my insurance company asked me all sorts of questions when I wanted to get insurance on the house that I live in. They wanted to know where the nearest fire hydrant was. They wanted to know a whole lot of things. And they determined the rate as a result of that. And all of these things come into play. And again, I hate to keep using the expression, but the point is that somebody is going to make sure that this doesn't happen, because somebody will have a profit-seeking interest in making sure that it doesn't happen. And that's the beauty of the free market. That is not the beauty of government regulation, because government regulation has political motivations rather than profit motivations. And political motivations are vastly different. Political motivations will reward the asbestos manufacturers. Political motivations will reward a lot of people who contribute money to the party. Political motivations will reward a lot of people who have political pull in Washington. Political motivations will not be aimed in the same direction as profit-seeking motivations, and the profit-seeking motivations will be aimed at in the direction of making sure that people are safe, people have effective products, people have user-friendly products, people are in a position to enjoy their products. And that's how they make money, rather than by having political pull in Washington. All right, we have a question from Dave, who asks, I was just wondering if you were still writing The War Racket, or is that one dead in the water? I remember you saying about a year or two ago that you were sorry for mentioning it because it ended up being a bigger undertaking than you had hoped or actually planned or expected, and you were thinking of chucking the idea. I hope to God you didn't chuck it, but I can certainly understand why you'd have to. By the way, if you did chuck it, do you plan to post what you've already written as standalone material on your website? I'm sure many of your readers, including me, would love to read it. Well, Dave, I'm glad you brought this up because I hadn't even thought about publishing this on the Internet. What I have so far, let me back up for the benefit of those who are unfamiliar with all of this. And that is that I started writing a book called The War Racket, The Lies, Promises, Propaganda, and so on, that have lured Americans into war after war after war. And the idea was to have a chapter on World War One, a chapter on World War Two, a chapter on the Korean War, and so forth, to show that they just keep coming back with the same old lies, the same old promises that are never, never made true. The lies turn out to be just the bald-faced variety, and they were there and known before the war began in order to lure Americans into war for some ulterior motive on the part of the president and the people around him. In World War II, Roosevelt got the Japanese to attack Pearl Harbor, provoked them into doing so by butting his nose into business that wasn't his in Far East Asia. And Harry Truman rushed into the Korean War without stopping to think that this was none of America's business. The U.S. got into the Vietnam War. The U.S. got into World War One, and in all these cases, promises were made about the better world that would result as a result of this. And, of course, the better world never materialized, whether it was making the world safe for democracy in World War One or liberating Europe and Asia in World War II, and in fact turning Europe and Asia over to the communists, or whatever it was. None of the promises materialized, and so on. So I began the task, and I did a great deal of research on World War One, and it was a fascinating story. I tell you, I knew the basics of World War One, but I didn't realize the depth of the deceptions that were perpetrated on the American people. And so it turned into a story much longer than one chapter, turned into an entire part of a book, 125 pages. And I'll continue this when we come back. The phone number is 1-800-259-9231. This is Harry Brown. Don't go away.
This is Harry Brown. My book, Why Government Doesn't Work, provides libertarian solutions to many of today's thorny political problems. How to make America much safer from foreign attack while reducing the military budget dramatically. How to end the Social Security program and free us from that oppressive tax without leaving senior citizens holding the bag. How to reduce crime while reducing government. How to end the income tax immediately and cut the federal budget by over 90%. How a libertarian president could reduce government even without a libertarian Congress. Why Government Doesn't Work is now available for downloading at libertyfree.com for only $9.75. Just $9.75 for Why Government Doesn't Work. You can read the book on your computer screen or print it out and read it from your easy chair. You can get Why Government Doesn't Work tonight at libertyfree.com.
This is Harry Brown. This is the Saturday Evening Libertarian Conversation. The phone number is 1-800-259-9231. And before we go to the phones, let me finish up on the war racket. The World War I material comprised a whole part of a book, 125 pages, really half of a manageable-sized book, and you know, a third or a quarter of a bigger size book. And I really didn't know what to do, plus this illness struck me, and it has reduced the number of hours that I can work in a day. And so I'm not sure exactly what to do as a result of that. But then along comes Dave to suggest that I publish the World War I material on the Internet. And I could do that. I might just send it first to a publisher that I know in New York, the editor-in-chief at a huge publishing company that's published several of my books already, and just see what he has to say. But I'm sure that he isn't going to want to say, let's publish this right away. This is really important stuff. So I might just publish it at libertyfree.com, where I'm publishing two books already for $9.75 apiece that can be downloaded and read on your computer screen or printed out and read in your easy chair. And do that, and then I have to say that three-quarters or more of the material for World War I was coming from books that I have read and investigated from what I consider to be reliable sources. But I also have so much material on the Iraq War from the Internet, almost entirely from the Internet, a little of it from books, but mostly from the Internet, from, again, what I consider to be reliable sources on the Internet, that I could then publish probably an equal size book of material on the Iraq War, all the different lies and deceptions, all the different propaganda, all the different promises that were made, and so on. And we see about that. So there is a possibility here. There'd be a lot of work to assemble that Iraq material, because just having it doesn't put it into book form. Just a lot of organizing to do and a lot of shaping and so forth. But it's something to think about, and I appreciate Dave's suggestion, because I think that's pointing me in the right direction. All right, let's go to the phones and talk to Eugene in Akron, Ohio. Good evening, Eugene.
Good evening, Harry. How you doing?
I'm just fine.
Okay, a few things. The first thing about cutting brush, this summer when the fires were raging, there was a guy in my office who said that for years in that area, the government said you could not cut trees if they were larger than 2 inches in diameter.
Oh, yes.
They're on the save the trees kick. So suddenly we had these fires, and hey, these trees burn. What do you know? So they started encouraging people to cut their trees near their home.
Yeah. Okay? That's very, very typical of the contradictory nature of these different laws and these different campaigns.
Okay, cut next. Circumstantial ethics. I was raised Catholic, and George Carlin talked about in his comedy routine that there would be something that would be a sin, like, say, eating meat on Friday,
mm-hmm.
and then they would put it in the weird circumstances. You know, the example he gave, okay, you're in the Pacific, you cross over the international date line, you know, can you eat meat or whatever?
So, it's not Friday anymore.
Right, so does that make it a sin? Okay. The Zimmerman telegram. I had always heard that was a hoax by the British. But I finally looked it up on the Internet and got a copy of it, and I really hope you print a copy of it on your book.
Oh, yes.
They did not want to go to war with the United States. And what they said, the equivalent of their Secretary of their State, on a telegram to their U.S. ambassador to the U.S., said, look, we're going to go back to unrestricted warfare. We hope the U.S. does not, you know, enter the war. But if they do, then go to Mexico offering them if they want to join us in the war. But their hope was to avoid a war with the United States.
Very definitely. And, yes, I am printing a copy of it in the book. For those who don't know, we're talking about World War One. The United States stayed out of the war from 1914 to 1917, and the British blockaded the North Sea and kept foodstuffs, even, as well as munitions, from reaching Germany. Germany did not have the naval capacity that the British did and had a very difficult time. They couldn't break the blockade, but they did have an advance in submarines. They were highly advanced in submarines, and they used those submarines to torpedo ships that were carrying munitions and so on to Britain from the United States and from other places. And they did everything they could to avoid trying to torpedo passenger ships and things of that sort. They occasionally slipped up, but it was obvious that their heart was in the right place. But what happened then was at the beginning of 1917, the Germans decided to do what, as you said, unrestricted warfare, which meant that they would just go for broke and they would shoot at everything that came along. And they said, this is bound to cause a problem with the United States, whom we're going to still try to keep the United States out of the war. But if we can't keep the United States out of the war, then we want you to go to the Mexican government and promise them that if they will join us on our side, then we will give them, we will see that they get back the southwestern states and will be returned to Mexico, states like Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. And they did not say we're going to war with the United States. They did not say that we want to go to war with the United States.
Right.
But Wilson made it seem as though that's what they were saying.
Right.
And so whether or not it was a hoax, it doesn't really concern us because it was not a declaration of war in any sense whatsoever.
Or a threat against the United States. And you mentioned not shooting passenger ships.
Mm-hmm.
They bring up the Lusitania, but that sank awfully fast for a ship with no ammunition on it.
Oh, yeah. There's no question that it was carrying munitions because of all the things that happened when it went down. And the Germans ran ads in the New York papers
that
they had the sailing and a few days before saying, don't sail on this ship. It's in jeopardy. It is vulnerable to being torpedoed, you know, so forth and so on, trying to keep Americans off the ship. It was not an American ship. It was a British passenger ship carrying munitions.
Yeah, I think it was even a reserve military ship.
Yes. Yes, I think you're right about that. Thank you for bringing those things up. All three of them on three different subjects were valuable. Anything else you want to add?
I do want to say, I think we should admit that liberty is not for everyone, not in the sense that they should be restricted, but for what they want, liberty will not be the answer, because a lot of people want to enslave and exterminate people. They want to control other people's lives through force. I can talk a lot longer, but you just gave such a great talk with the first three ones, but I just want to make that last point that for many people, liberty is not the answer for what they want.
Right, but that's a marketing question.
Okay.
Okay, thanks so much, Eugene. We'll be back in just a minute, 3 minutes, folks. Stay tuned. Hello again, Harry Brown here. This is the Saturday Evening Libertarian Conversation. The phone number is 1-800-259-9231. And just like Eugene in Akron, Ohio, you are invited to give us your comments and your ideas having anything to do with liberty, government, whatever. And Eugene finished by saying that liberty is not for everyone. And this is, of course, a marketing problem. It is not a problem in trying to decide what kind of society would be the most fruitful, the fairest, the most effective, and so on. What it means is that there are any salesman knows, various degrees of a prospect. A prospect may be just waiting for you to come along to say the magic words, and he will fall in your arms and say, oh boy, now it all makes sense. Or he may be just absolutely full of resistance, and he may be anywhere in between. And if he's absolutely full of resistance and he is just determined that he wants to dictate to other people how they should live and this, that, and the other thing, then recognize that, that there are better prospects around. And you only have so much time. You only have so much energy. There's only so much you can do. Use that, use those resources with people that are real prospects, people who are closer to the first end of the scale rather than the last end of the scale. And this is an important thing, as I say, that any successful salesman has learned long since in his career. And I think it's important for us as salesmen of liberty to realize this too. I got a question from Alex out in cyberspace. And I'm not sure what the motivation was here. And I say I got the following question. I actually got 10 questions. He says, I asked the following questions, and they're all about Iraq before the war started. And I'm not sure whether he's challenging me, saying, yeah, you answer these questions and you'll show that the Iraqi war was justified, or whether he just is asking for information. Number one, did Saddam use chemicals designed for weapons of mass destruction against the Kurds? We'll probably never know for sure, although there are plenty of Kurds still alive who could testify to this. But there is a lot of dispute over the just cut and dried idea that Hussein used these chemicals against his own people. Why in the world would he use the chemicals against his own people? He was fighting a war against Iran, and it was all up at the Kurdish border there with Iran. And there was nothing to be achieved by gassing the Kurds, the way George Bush says over and over again, he gassed his own people. What was to be accomplished by that? There is a lot of evidence to show that the particular kind of gas that was used was a gas that was used by the Iranians, because both sides used gas in that war. And we assume that the Iranians used it against the Iraqis, and the Iraqis used it against the Iranians. It's the only thing that does make sense. And in this case, the Kurds would be the Iraqis, because they were the Iraqis that were there in that area of the country. So nobody knows, at least in this country for sure. All we know is what George Bush keeps saying, and George Bush has long since been discredited. Number two, did Saddam have illegal missiles that could reach the outer fringes of European nations? Well, it turned out that those missiles that could supposedly go far, far beyond the United Nations restrictions could only travel about 75 miles. So the answer there is no. Three, did Saddam retain scientists on his payroll who could create the illegal chemicals in a matter of weeks that could be used in those missiles? Possibly so. I don't know, but none of it was done. Number four, did Saddam pay each family of a suicide bomber $25,000 for killing Israelis? That's what I've been told. I don't know what the figure was, but I've been told that he gave rewards for suicide bombers that went in and killed Israelis. So possibly the answer to that is yes. Five, did Saddam slaughter tens of thousands of his own people? I don't know. I only know what George Bush said. Number six, did Saddam cause the torture and or rape of people? I don't know that either. I only know what George Bush says. Number seven, did Saddam pay billions of oil for food money in bribes to principals of three of the four nations who voted action by the UN after the UN Security Council voted unanimously for Resolution 1441? I presume here that the implication is that Saddam used oil for food money to bribe people in Germany, France, and Russia and get them to vote to veto action by the UN so that the UN would not go to war against Iraq. And I have no knowledge of that whatsoever. and it seems very unlikely. Number nine, was Iraq firing missiles at our surveillance aircraft in violation of the agreement he signed? Of course he was firing missiles at our surveillance aircraft. Those surveillance aircraft were dropping bombs on Iraq, and they were flying over Iraq regularly, dropping bombs. And in fact, it's been said now that those bombing raids were practice runs for the war that was coming. And any country would fire back at aircraft that was violating its airspace. And lastly, are the records that reveal Saddam paid $300,000 to al-Zarqawi, who is Osama bin Laden's advisor and supporter? I have no idea. We'll be right back. This is Harry Brown.
If you produce computer storage media, you need GlideRite test heads. GlideRite is a major supplier of test heads to most media manufacturers in the U.S. and Asia. In addition, GlideRite produces glide heads, burnish heads, certifier heads, and thermal asperity heads, focusing on meeting your specific needs with short turnaround times and optimum quality, all at a competitive price. GlideRite's delivery performance is unmatched, whether quantities are large or small. GlideRite has manufacturing facilities in Milpitas, California, and Ho Chi Minh, Vietnam. Each site is equipped with state-of-the-art tooling and computerized equipment. GlideRite's services include research and development, new design and technology, and engineering support. Whether you need standard heads or customized solutions, GlideRite is your expert source. So when designing hard disks, always specify GlideRite.
This is Harry Brown, and this is the last segment of this hour, but we'll have another full hour to go after the news, so stay aboard. Here's a question from Tom out in Chandler, Arizona. While the Libertarian Party is the party of principle, does that mean it can't play politics? For example, one of the barriers to third-party success is the electoral college system. Only the votes of those in the plurality really count in most states. Why not turn that system back on the big two parties? The LP could pick one of the big two for special opposition, then focus all LP resources on the few close states, ones within a few percent of going to either party. Specifically work to dilute the support of the chosen party there. If the Republicans are chosen, the LP message would emphasize smaller government and lower taxes to draw votes away from the Republican Party. If the Democratic Party is chosen, the LP message could emphasize protection of civil liberties, separation of church and state, and so on. Yes, I'm suggesting the LP deliberately play the role of spoiler for the chosen party, or at least convince that party that that's what happened. Why would the LP want to do such a thing? After all, it's bound to draw criticism from party loyalists who feel their party was entitled to win and the LP knocked them down. Well, for one thing, there's a small chance that the LP might do their job so well that they'd end up getting a few electoral votes. Well, we can dream. Then there's the old axiom that there's no such thing as bad publicity. Any exposure that shows the LP having any kind of power will benefit the LP with those who would like to vote libertarian but don't want to waste their vote. Perhaps deliberately choose to oppose the incumbent, since contributing to throwing out an incumbent politician appears more powerful. Further, the two major parties will be forced to rethink the power of third parties. If the LP is really successful after a few spoiled elections, the big parties might join in a bipartisan call for an end to the outmoded electoral college system, figuring they'd be safer with one voter, one vote. And finally, when pundits start spouting how evil the LP is for deliberately thwarting the will of the people, the controversy will create opportunities to expose the hypocrisy of those defending a system so well designed to lock out third parties that is commonly known as the two-party system. Frankly, I see no downside for the LP and no conflict with libertarian principles. Do you? Well, You've given us a lot to think about there, Tom, and let's take this time with the news to think about it before I give you my thoughts on this, because there's something that's being overlooked here, and it's being overlooked with many such plans that are suggested by people as a way of finally getting the LP to have a breakthrough after all these years. So, think about it while we listen to the news, and when we come back, I'll give you my thoughts on this, and you can give me your thoughts by calling 1-800-259-9231. This is Harry Brown.